like this is that it was ours, and nobody in political circles took ownership of it, and so it really, you know, created a momentary stir, and then people went on with their agendas as before.
Right.
It's really difficult to get inside. Now, again, we have...
Mr. Marshall, would it be all right if I tape record our conversation?
Oh, sure.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so go ahead. So it was nobody. You owned it, but the
we did get some politicians involved in it to come and speak to the participants and help them make some of their suggestions because you know they needed a little bit of a guideline along the way. And that was very useful, but those people didn't then exactly then take it themselves and run with it, nor did we really expect them to. We brought them on to add some guidance, some experience with actually dealing with these things so that the participants that we chose from across the country would be able to ask them questions as they go, would this be a reasonable thing to do, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up not really... we created quite a fuss. It was raised in the House of Commons. It was discussed nationally. We had a partner, one of our TV networks, CTV, had their cameras there throughout the event and throughout the weekend that we worked on this this blueprint and did a I think it was a two-part program. On it and got some pretty fair numbers for it.
Right.
But, we frankly did stretch our resources to the limit in order to do it. We didn't have the resources to stay on top of it on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Though the people who participated in it would have been happy to do that. They made it very clear that they found this exercise to be an exciting one that they would be happy to keep involved in. We simply didn't have the resources to keep it going.
So was it McLean's hope that a seed would have been planted and somebody would have kept it going?
Yes. Our hope was that we would have established a couple of things. One, the fact that a dialogue involving people from all parts of this country speaking to each other and discussing the differences face-to-face made a big difference. Since that time, there has been a tremendous upsurge, at least for a few years, in things called town halls, where politicians, including the Prime Minister, would get in front of a selected audience representing the country, right across the country, and submit to their questioning, and then the people there would talk to each other. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister got hammered in a couple of these and didn't really like them very much.
Which Prime Minister was that?
This is Jean Chrétien.
Okay.
And in fact, accused the CBC network, which set these up, of having kind of fixed the questions against him, so that he,
I see.
So that it looked like he really took this very personally. He
uh-huh.
Pissed him off so badly.
Was there any substance to his concern?
So it's very hard to say. I mean, the thing is, when you set up something like that, you do have people all across the country, all hooked up, all ready to go. Any phone-in radio show, somebody will pre-interview whoever's on the line, saying, what do you want to talk to them about? Have some ideas. So, in fact, they were capable of saying, okay, we're only going to direct hostile questions to the Prime Minister. They say they did nothing of the sort, though. They say that, they tried to make it as even-handed as they possibly could.
Right.
It's just a disagreement.
Right.
That is no way of really getting to the bottom of it.
Right, right. Well, let me back up just a second, if I could, and refer to the introductory reporting that you did
right.
to that exercise.
Right.
At the time, you wrote... The time was short, the pressure was intense, and still they managed to work some magic.
Yeah.
Why was it magic? What was the magic that you witnessed there?
The fact that at the beginning of the weekend, there was a tremendous disparity in opinions. If you go through this, through the dialogue of the weekend, you'll notice that a couple of Westerners were unable to even contemplate for a second what a couple of Quebecers were saying.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lawyer from Richmond, B.C., named Richard Miller.
Right.
Who turned out to have a very powerful personality. He was anti any concessions to Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
There was another lawyer from Montreal, Charles Dupuis, equally powerful.
Mm-hmm.
They, in the first few minutes of this exercise, were head-to-head.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of sussed each other out in the positions and were very critical of each other.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them formed an incredibly firm friendship by the time the weekend was over.
Mm.
They ended up admiring each other immensely and coming to understand each other's point of view
mm-hmm.
an awful lot more. Both of them were marveling at the end of the weekend
mm-hmm.
how much they understood about mm-hmm. the opposite point of view. Neither one of them changed their mind, but they found lots of common ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the magic we were referring to. They were the best example of it, but there were many, many, many other subtle ones where Quebecers who were, you know, with some Federalist tendencies had those reaffirmed and sort of celebrated their Canadianness. Other people, sort of, their awareness level shot up enormously in the course of this. They're all chosen because they had some interest in the process, but not necessarily because they were very deeply involved in what was happening in
right.
confession.
Right. So later, just a couple of graphs below that excerpt that I just quoted,
yeah.
you identified that the imaginative approach that was involved entailed real dialogue.
Yeah.
Is that the source of the magic?
Well, that's part of it. I was going to go on when I was saying, first of all, you bring people together and you allow them to talk to each other and hear what the other person has to say face to face.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. We've got a very big country. So do you. I mean, these are enormous countries. If one region has a resentment against another region, it's very difficult for those residents to actually get to the truth of matters without the filters that are in place. And those filters have prevented, have always prevented individuals in Canada from understanding. I'm going off a little bit on a tangent, but one tool or method of increasing Canadian understanding that an awful lot of people have been promoting for many years without a lot of success is travel. There have been many politicians, as well as others in this country, who have looked for ways to promote travel by Canadians. In a lot of cases, there are great exchange programs on across the country to allow Canadians from, you know, high school level Canadians to go and live with people in other parts of the country and get to understand those other parts of the country. There's also been a lot of proposals for tax deductions on travel within the country, so people, you know, if they travel at least two provinces away or something like that, would get to have some sort of tax deduction on their travel. None of which has ever been translated into policy, but there's a general recognition that that kind of thing helps. So what we were trying to do was bring people together and sort of put that theory to a test and say,
mm-hmm.
okay, we're going to sit these people together. They're going to be forced to interact with each other for long hours at a time. What's going to come from it? But then we also added to that mix the expertise of the Harvard Negotiation Project,
mm-hmm.
the idea of the conflict resolution techniques that Roger Fisher and others there have had an enormous amount of success with in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing whether using those on the actual citizens of the country would work in the same way as they seem to have worked on a more remote group, and that is the leadership in other settings, labor or international or whatever. And they worked extremely well. I mean, these people were very good at what they did, and the people there took to them. Our conclusion was that kind of technique could be used more effectively in other areas of Canadian dialogue. You know, if we have national conferences to discuss issues, well, maybe there should be some kind of conflict resolution specialist there to help them overcome their differences, to help them try to isolate what it is about their differences that they should be focusing on in order to try to resolve them.
Mm-hmm. So the combination of those elements was the apparatus that was yeah. was being tested there,
yeah.
and that you see as the source of the magic that
yeah.
you witnessed.
Yeah.
Right.
And we also said that our conclusion was that anybody could do this. You know that. It,
right.
You know that, that having done it here, we could, it showed we could do it. We could
right.
continue to do it. 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 Oh yeah. Well, I was just going to say that Roger Fisher, in fact, got a lot of business out of this. He got quite a few calls on the basis of this. I'm not quite sure whether they did anything for the government, or the, any government in Canada, as a result of this thing.
I have a call into him now. I don't know if I'll be successful in tracking him down.
Well, if you can find him through Harvard, and if he's still connected with them, that's right. Yet another person to talk to there is Rob Resigliano.
Right, okay.
He's brilliant. he was very strong. And I would really recommend that you track him down. The last I heard, he was still with them. He was in touch with somebody here just a couple of years ago.
Okay.
So he may be there, and he'll remember it, I'm sure, quite well. He's very, he's a vital guy. He'll do it.
I gather from the reporting, he too was quite moved by the outcome.
He was in tears at the end. That was great.
Yeah.
That's true. Was, and the people loved him. I mean, the panel just loved him. He was the one who most got to the hearts. Fisher is a more, an intellectual, aloof sort of character, very sort of leadership, lots of leadership qualities about him, mm-hmm. but not the same human touch that Rob
right.
brought to it.
Right, right. So I wanted to ask you about that. As well, from reading the reporting, you get a very strong sense of the emotion that was involved at the resolution.
Right.
You were there and saw that. How do you understand that emotion? Where did it come from? Why were people so stirred by the experience?
Well, it's like, to me, it was like a. Any kind of crisis when it comes to a head, it brings out these emotions. Canadians are not flag wavers.
Right.
We take a sort of determined pride in not being flag wavers.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean we can't be touched by references to our country and to our nation. This is one case where after this, you could almost call it grueling. I mean, they were pushed into. Decision-making or deadlines a lot faster than they really wanted to be. They felt a lot of pressure on themselves. And when they got something that they felt strongly about and felt they were pleased with, and it seemed to them to represent some sort of key to keeping their country together,
right?
They found that very emotional.
Right.
And I think that overtiredness by the end of the week had a role to play in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody was feeling pretty strung out by the time we finished.
Mm-hmm.
These people were also socializing in the evening. They were getting to know each other and hanging around the bar and really having a very, very good time of it. They ended up forming some very good friendships, kept in touch with each other afterwards and so on. So I think that was part of it, is that there was kind of a... I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but sort of they reached a kind of climax in their quest, and sort of broke emotionally.
Right, right.
And they came out of it, including Rob, which was interesting to see because he's been doing this a lot.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to follow up on that, but. Weave in this other interesting consideration. There was an interesting sidebar that you included in that editorial package with the head, "Elected People Must Decide." And are you looking at the magazine there?
Yeah, I am. I'm, what on, page is that?
On page 48.
Page 48.
And the point is that while McLean's, the lead says, while McLean's Forum was producing its vision of a Canada in which politicians would be more responsive to their constituents, 17-member parliamentary committee was putting finishing touches right. on a report, etc. And so McLean's, with the help of its polling firm, Harvard Negotiating Project, right. and so forth, was exploring the possibilities of this more consultative or deeply, potentially deeply consultative and dialogic process of government. There was an analogous, I gather, subject being discussed in Parliament, but the conclusion was, as Mr. Edwards said, that elected leaders must decide.
Right.
And so I got the impression as I was reading that, that here on the one hand was a process being discussed that would enable a great deal more citizen participation and reflection in the decisions made by elected people. But Parliament at that moment was discussing a modification of the process and
right.
essentially rejecting such an idea.
Right.
Is that a fair interpretation?
Well, if you ask us, yes, we think that's a completely fair interpretation. But we do have, obviously, an interest in this, and so maybe we're not the best source. but I think... We did see that line, that elected people, after all, elected people must decide, as a bit of an example of the deaf ears of which this was going to fall. That if people were in elected positions, take the idea that they're here to make decisions and nobody else is.
Right.
Then we're in that sort of John Stuart Mill conundrum of, who do we, what does an elected official do, and how much is he responsible to the electorate? Is that right? Is it Mill? Anyway, it doesn't matter. I mean, this is the conundrum that elected officers face. Is that they have to be counted on to make decisions in the best interest of the people they represent, but they also have to be counted on to listen to people. This is a big, big, big debate in Canada, as it is in the States. We have a lot more pressure now for recall legislation, for instance, to be able to, some of which has been put into practice in British Columbia, trying to throw elected officials out of office for
right.
keeping their promises to the electorate,
right.
for not consulting them properly, and so on. I don't think anyone has yet worked has actually achieved that end, but it's been tried. And what we were seeing happening is, at the time that we did this exercise, was very little recognition from anybody we spoke to that this was how government was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
What we did see, though, was a great deal of, maybe more than lip service, but it does seem to be more like lip service because it's disappeared, attention to the kind of town hall things that I talked about. And politicians talking more about listening to the people, and that did happen for several years. But I wouldn't say it's a big feature of government, and certainly it's not something the governments get themselves reelected on.
Right.
They don't promise to have town halls. They don't promise to set up citizen consultative committees or anything like that. And there's not a huge groundswell of demand for them to do that.
Right, right. In this country, I think it's been 10 or 11 years now, Elizabeth Drew, the political writer for The New Yorker, did a piece that was created quite a stir called Money and Politics. And it just chronicled the extent to which corporations, through lobbyists, are now effectively, pretty much managing the process of governance in the U.S., and the issue just gets hotter and hotter and hotter, although there's probably a pretty fair amount of fatigue in the American public now around this issue. But in this country, certainly, and I know from friends in British Columbia, I live just below the border and I've got many friends up there, there's a perception in BC, certainly around forestry issues, that the representative government is not taking place, or at least what the government is representing is not the interests of the public. It's industry interests. It's corporate interests.
Yeah.
And that's a huge issue in this country. Do you have a sense of just how much of a chance this approach to consultative government has in the context of modern political reality, and if it does have a chance, you know, what needs to be changed in order to give it a chance?
Well, not really, no. I mean, the issues you're talking about are issues here too, of course. Socialist National Party, the Democratic Party, makes a big issue of that in any election. They constantly are making the point that from their perspective, our government is in the hands of the major corporations. That globalization has made that problem even worse. And in fact, the government's hands are being tied not even by Canadian companies, but by big multinationals. If people are concerned about that, and I have no doubt they are, certainly, for instance, the letters to our editor and that sort of thing, you remember the multilateral agreement on investment that
right.
sort of finally run down and died a sad death late last year, I guess it was. Canadians generally were delighted that it didn't go, but they were frightened that it could even have been contemplated to that extent. And there was a lot of basic panic over that in the editorial columns, op-ed columns, and so on in Canada. The concept that even more shots are going to be called to the multinationals, that even less decision-making is left in the hands of the individual voter. That concern certainly was big last year because MAI died and isn't so far showing any signs of being resurrected. It's not a big issue. We've had a provincial election here in Ontario, and that kind of issue really didn't come up. The Conservative government, which is basically pro-business, pro-laissez-faire, government, got handily reelected despite two parties screaming that it was, didn't represent the people and was simply representing big money.
Mm-hmm.
But it also promised a tax. It had delivered some tax cuts and was promising more, and clearly hit the right nerve with Canadians and our economy, or with Ontarians. And this is the biggest province in Canada, and the economy is booming. Largely due to the enormously successful American economy, but the government was able to take some credit for this booming economy. Their argument being that giving money back to the people or lowering taxes got more money into the economy and created a mm-hmm. stronger economy. So, I mean, yes, people are concerned about that, but when you look at the actual results of their concerns, you see that it doesn't stop a very strongly pro-business government from getting re-elected in Ontario, and it certainly doesn't stop the Liberal government in Ottawa from being a fairly business-oriented government. They've found a nice middle line. It's very difficult for them to be attacked from either side these days because they've sort of co-opted both a social mandate, which they take quite seriously, and a really strong, hard-headed, business-like approach to government. So they're being quite successful with that combination.
You know, in this country, during the Clinton-Bush presidential election, there was that famous line from Clinton about what the governing issue really was in that election. It's the economy, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
The implication being that...
That was Carville's line, wasn't it? And
who?
Carville. James Carville. Didn't he put that up in the... that's my recollection of it. He put it up in the briefing room.
In the briefing room, yeah. But it became Clinton's...
Yeah, it became the line, that's right.
Yeah. And clearly, there's every indication that that's the ethic that that administration is operating
right,
out of
right.
now.
Right.
Keep a chicken in every pot, and that's what the country really concerned about. And so the idea is that it's kind of a litmus test of our values, I guess. What do we really believe in modern society
right.
anymore? Is it issues of freedom, democracy, social justice, or is it is it, you know, purely pragmatic, what's in it for me kinds of considerations? And the debate is always raging about, you know, that emerges from the Elizabeth Drew kinds of reporting that shows that there are these huge sums of money being spent by multinationals and funneled into the political process by lobbyists. But when you really weigh those two considerations, what's causing the politics that we have, the government that we have, is it the manipulation of vested interest groups, or is it really a reflection of what's in the modern public's heart these days? What's your take on that?
Well, it's a major question. I'll tell you one thing. Canadians were very puzzled by the collapse of the healthcare initiative, Hillary Clinton's healthcare initiative. From our perspective, we've only had a government legislated healthcare system here for 30 years, but it has become perhaps our most solid identifying factor. I mean, this is Canadians equate healthcare with being Canadian, and anybody who tries to fiddle with our healthcare does it at their own peril. And there's just a total. I mean, I'm old enough to have remembered the debate as it went through, and the accusations that this was creeping socialism, and that, you know, communists were behind this, and you know, and it was a tough. It was a very emotional, and the rhetoric level was extremely high, and I can remember being swayed by it, thinking that you know, these doctors are the best people to make the decision. Why take it out of their hands and put it in the hands of some faceless bureaucrats, et cetera, et cetera? Well, I mean, we have fallen in love with our healthcare system. In fact, we only want it to get more and more, expanded more and more in this country. And we see it as a great failure of the Americans to look after the weak in their society through a universal health care system. It's monumentally seen, or fundamentally seen in Canada that way, as a lack of compassion on the part of Americans. And we thought that if a Clinton government couldn't do that. No, I shouldn't say, I won't say fundamentally seen, because I'll go on in a second. We thought that if the Clinton government administration couldn't do anything with that, well, then who could? I mean, what president have we seen? Well, Jimmy Carter was another example, but what president have we seen that can so easily speak from his heart about the, you know, the pain of others? I mean, he's almost a cliche with Clinton. But if he can't, if his administration can't make any headway against that, with the kind of popular support it has had, then you understand the nature of the vested interests that he's up against.
Right.
And they're obviously extremely, extremely powerful.
Right.
You know, they make the gun lobby look weak. I mean,
yeah.
But I was going to say as well that there are Canadians who see health care as a sign of the weakness in our society. I have to say that there are a number of people who always are expressing their opinion, saying that that's our downfall, you know, that we coddle our people too much. And those are the people who tend to want to move to the States and say, I can take care of myself. I don't need any government to take care of me. I will buy the insurance I need, and I will live a good life. And we get a lot of letters from those people but in the States saying, I've done it, you know, and this is what I do. And then we get letters from Canadians saying, yeah, well, you're paying more in your insurance than you would be in paying taxes here, so shut up. So, you know,
right.
It's one of those classic arguments that nobody can win it, and it's just a matter of preference. But, you know, the Medicare model wins by a mile in Canada. It's just not going to be touched.
Right, right. Finally, and I guess particularly now with the benefit of 8 years that have lapsed since you did that, do you have any advice for anybody who is interested in attempting to institutionalize the process that you experimented with?
Well, I'd say, well, I guess I could break that into a couple of levels. Journalistically, it was a wonderful exercise.
Uh-huh.
It got us a lot of attention, which is one of the things we have to do. It got people talking. It won us several awards, and we think it was quite effective in that respect. I mean, we are, after all, a business enterprise. We're out there trying to shake things up a bit and get people to pay attention to us, and that really did that. It as well as anything we've done in the past decade, that's certainly among them. As for anybody else taking it up, would we do it again? I'm not sure, because the result, though we thought it was fascinating and interesting and showed a lot of promise for the kinds of decision-making that could be made, I suppose suggested such a daunting change, such an expensive change in the way we're doing things. I mean, if the government put together the resources to call, representative conventions together on all sorts of policies and get people talking so on, it could cost a real bundle. They've already done that, they would say. They have the House of Commons where people come and do that. And they presumably, the argument is that a member of parliament from Prince Edward Island meets a member of parliament from Saskatchewan on a regular basis in caucus meetings and in the parliamentary restaurant and in all sorts of settings, and they learn to understand each other, and they're able to carry back a message to their own voters that helps further the sort of the national message.
Right.
I mean, those things are in place to some extent, and I think it's naive to think that the kind of exercise we did is simply because we saw some success in it is going to revolutionize the way people do government.
What strikes me is a marked departure from the House of Commons exercise in what you pioneered in the representative government mm-hmm. exercise that we have in this country, and what you pioneered is the very sophisticated use of your polling firm. I mean, that combination
yeah.
of portraying the true psyche of the country
right.
at any given moment, and
yeah.
then methodically selecting representatives
right.
of that point of view
right.
is quite unlike anything that operates
right.
in the U.S., even though the statement that you just made, I'm sure, would be made by every U.S. elected official
right.
that we already have
right.
representative government.
Right. Well, okay, I mean, I hadn't even mentioned that in my earlier in my remarks. That was a fascinating exercise. I mean,
uh-huh.
I was deeply involved in that for several months as we worked out our lists and went through them and pre-interviewed and did all that sort of stuff. And I found it just absolutely compelling. And the extent to which people we were talking to really wanted to get involved in this was really quite something to see too. You'd have to question. I mean, frankly, you have to wonder whether the method we chose was truly the right one.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take doing it quite often, I guess, to get some sense of that. But, you know, we were very satisfied with the method. But, I mean, what do you test it against? How do you know whether we really did a very good job of getting the people that we were looking for? We applied what was available, which is quite, I mean, the firm we used, Decima, is a very, very well-established polling firm with the best resources that, you know. You could ask for. So we're certainly able to create the kind of base of respondents that we needed to create our group. We're able to sort of dig into this base and say, now we're underrepresented on this kind of thing. Where do we get them? Well, we don't have a good geographical balance. We ended up with the same number of men and women. We ended up with people representing demographic differences quite varied. Money, education, age, you know, we liked what we got, and if we did it again, we may have found a group of people that didn't interact as well. I mean, I don't know how you finally get a group. We're
right.
Lucky. We got a group of people who really did set off the chemistry among each other.
Right.
Including one fellow who was determined to move to the States and did within a year.
Yeah.
And for precisely the reasons I was talking about, this is a coddling society. It'll never go anywhere unless it gives people a chance to rise on their own two feet. And he felt very strongly about that. got a lot of antipathy from the rest of them. Everyone else felt just disagreed with him heartily and just couldn't stand to hear him making this pitch.
That was Colin.
That's right. Yeah, uh-huh. And he made himself quite unpopular by the time it was over, but it didn't change his mind at all. I mean, he just stuck to his guns, and you know, good for him. I mean, he had his way of looking at things, and I can't remember. He went to California, I believe, and wrote to us from there.
Mm. Right.
So, I mean. I mean, anybody could do it. How successful they'd be doing it, what it really means. I mean, I guess what happened is, although we produced what we thought was an incredibly logical and workable kind of proposal, I guess it didn't, for other people who were equally devoted to this particular cause, they probably thought what they were doing had just as much value as this one did. So, unless we were able to devote ourselves to furthering it ourselves and taking it to whatever limit we could and trying to create the forums that would promote some of these things. For instance, I mentioned that traveling thing. I think that is one of the recommendations, if I recall, that you know all Canadians be
right. It is
encouraged to travel. And,
yeah. Are there any informed critics or skeptics of what you did who you recall, who you would refer me to?
I can't recall any, to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. I don't recall anybody taking us on, mm-hmm. you know, saying this is just the wrong approach.
Right.
I think it was seen as, I don't know if you ever saw this, The New Yorker, I think, once said that the most boring headline in the world would be "Worthy Canadian Initiative." I think in a lot of cases this was seen as a worthy Canadian initiative. It was doing the right thing, so you can't really damn it. It was going in the right direction.
Right.
No, I can't. I mean, you know what I could do, though, is I could ask our library to look at the our letters columns in the issues following that to see, because I just can't remember offhand, to see if anybody surfaced with some damning criticism.
That would be fascinating. I mean, if there was a knowledgeable, credentialed source who said, you know, we're already doing this, or you know, look, you know, this doesn't represent any particular innovation over what already happens in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
That would be interesting to follow up on.
I could also get you numbers for Charles Dupuis and Richard Miller. Both of them terrifically articulate guys.
Thank you. I would like that.
Now, I could get their old numbers. I haven't tracked them. I haven't heard anything from them for the last 5 years or so.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure, but I'll look at those. What's your number, Larry?
It's 509
747
8776. And my email, if that would be helpful, is lwshook, SHOOK, @AOL.com. Now,